Report, and we're your hosts. I'm Diane Bortoletto.
And I'm Monique Chicardo.
Let's do it.
Hello, hello, and welcome to And Away We Go F1 podcast, a Formula One podcast that goes beyond the track limits to talk about travel, food, and lifestyle surrounding the sport. I'm Diane Bortoletto, your pre-Drive to Survive Formula One fan, and today I'm in Margaret River.
And I'm Monique Chicardo, your post-Drive to Survive fan, and today I'm back at home in Stavanger in southwestern Norway.
Good to have you home, and we've got a super exciting episode ahead, and a guest who's been an industry friend of mine for over 20 years. It'd have to be over 20 years now. It's with great pleasure to introduce Greg Rust. So if you've been to the Australian Grand Prix, you would have heard his voice over the PA system. He's been a lifelong motorsport fan. He was going to the track with his parents before he could even walk. He's been the face of Network 10's motorsport program for more than a decade, and he's been broadcasting for, I'll let Greg tell the story. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Hello, Di. Hello, Monique. And yes, I think when we first started working together, I wasn't grey. I'm grey now.
Aren't we all?
I love the fact that you, in the introduction to this pod, you both talk about either being pre-Drive to Survive or post-Drive to Survive. And my world is actually, believe it or not, a mixture of both, because Di's just kind of summarised a bit of my career there and some of the things I've done around Formula One with different broadcasters and so on. But my kids are deeply invested in it now. I have teenage daughters and they love it from Drive to Survive. So I'm actually seeing it, Monique, through a different set of eyes now. Like I look at it and I go, who qualified where or what has happened here? And they come to me and they go, hey, Dad, have you seen what Charles' girlfriend is doing? And I go, what? You know, so that in itself, which I'm sure we'll get to in the conversation, the fact they've been able to tap into both, I think is just not in, you know, my capabilities. It's a masterstroke, isn't it? They've been able to do that with both audiences.
Yeah.
And how nice for you as a dad that works in this industry to have your children be interested in your industry, not necessarily through the means that you've given them, but all of a sudden they are interested in your industry. Like, that's so cool.
Monique, thank you. And I try and, like anything, I try and encourage them, right? But you want to be a dad who lets them go and explore, be self-starting and all of those sort of things. But over the past couple of years, they've both come and worked with me at the Grand Prix in Melbourne. So when I worked there, I work on a thing called GPTV, and they had a staff member who wasn't able to be with them because of a clashing job. And they said, would the girls come and be a production assistant for us? So both of them have come and worked there and absolutely loved it. So Georgie, our eldest, who's now off studying comms at university, she did it for 2 years. And Stella, our youngest, who's in her second last year of high school, has come and done it as well. And super fortunate. They've been able to go behind the scenes with the F1 social media team and do all these things. I mean, I'm in the midst of work trying to be like proper serious, and I get this message, hey, Dad, I'm in the second row of the press conference. I'm like, oh my God, they're in places I don't even get to go to, you know? So we're very fortunate that Tim and Fran did that, and that the Grand Prix Corporation have in the same way we were just talking about before, right, encouraged young women, encouraged young people to celebrate the sport, be involved in the sport in all sorts of different ways. It's a little entree for them, but it's up to them where they take it, I guess, from there.
It's so cool.
I know. Like, I remember you put up a post a little while ago, Rusty. I think you took one of your daughters somewhere and you said, I think I might get cool dad status with this. I can't remember where it was. I think it was something to do with the Australian Grand Prix. And I'm like, oh my God.
It would have been the event that they hold on the Wednesday night, which is called Glamour on the Grid. And you know me.
Oh my God, stop.
You know me. I am a... Monique, let me paint this picture for you, right? I am a fish out of water deals.
I'm so jealous.
Yeah, you might be, but I'm a fish out of water when it comes to those deals, right? I'm terrible. They know exactly what they're doing. All these people, Dad, we're going to stay here to the finish. And okay, right. So, yes, for a little while, Di, I earned a couple of frequent family points. I got a few back in the bank.
And very remiss of me in the introduction not to mention Rusty's Garage. You've got your own fabulous motorsport podcast, which you've been running for what is it, about 8 years now, Rusty? Yeah. So tell us about some of the guests that you've had on, some of the Formula One related guests you've had on the pod.
It was a bit of an experiment for me, Di, because I'm a good friend of Mark Howard, who has a world-leading podcast called The Howie Games. And he said, look, they're looking for someone to do a bit of automotive and motor racing-based podcast, would you be interested? So toward the end of 2017, I kind of started whiteboarding with them what this might look like. We did a pilot with Molly Taylor, the rally star. So that was the formation of it. Mark Webber came on. Oscar Piastri's been on for a couple of short casts. Liam Lawson I deal with in New Zealand and beyond, so he's been on a couple of times too. Jenson Button, Giancarlo Fisichella, there's a few of them that are in there. I'm very fortunate with many of them, just through work, I guess, over time, you forge a bit of a rapport and off you go. So, yeah.
I'm curious to know what Liam Lawson's like behind the scenes. If you've had conversational chats with him, what's he like?
He's a great guy. So, I mean, I'm talking to you tonight from New Zealand. My wife is a Kiwi, so I spend a lot of time. I live here, but I do broadcast work on both sides of the Tasman. And through that, through a thing called the Tony Quinn Foundation and a lot of the circuits that are over here, I've been able to meet and deal with him before he made it to Formula One. So I got to see the kind of human being that he is a bit more. He met me in Singapore the year before he got his kind of first big crack at it with what we now know as Racing Bulls. And since then, we've caught up on a couple of occasions, and he's terrific. So I felt for him with what happened at the beginning of the year. Monique, maybe you're leaning into that there, but he's shown, and it's a word we all probably overuse in some ways, but he has genuinely shown great resilience, and I'm so pleased for him that he's bouncing back at the moment. That's really cool. Someone said to me the other day, it might have been James Allen or one of those long time people embedded in the sport, that they believe he's done enough to stay there for 2026. And I really hope that's the case.
Yeah, I agree with you. I feel like he's got a quiet resilience, and he's just been plugging away in the background there, not making too much noise, not making too much fuss, but he's getting the results now. And, you know, that comes with a quiet determination.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, he had loud determination too. But
yeah, you know, his family have given up a lot for him to get to this point. There are some Kiwi people behind the scenes that have helped support him. He's both. He's both racer, but he's also tailor-made, right, for the Drive to Survive generation. I mean, can play a guitar, all those sort of things, and just a good bloke, yeah.
Yeah, well, hopefully we see more of
him.
Yeah. I felt sorry for him, I've got to admit, because he was so hyped up going to Red Bull, you know, toward the end of last year and at the start of the season. And to be in that cursed second seat next to Max Verstappen, it was just so tough, especially because he was, like I said, so hyped up in the media and everywhere. And then just to be treated the way he was treated. And I felt really sorry for him. But like you've said, he's kept his head down, and he's now quietly, like, he's progressed as the season's gone on, which is really encouraging to
see. That could be the sort of scenario that absolutely breaks you. And the fact that he's been able to rebound, and with good people around him too, from Laurent Mekies before he moved on to Red Bull, and Alain Permain there now, and so on. There's a real core group that I think have helped lift him up, but he's lifted himself up. And to your point, Di, around the beginning of the year, I spoke to him. He was here in New Zealand over summer. And we had an event at the Taupo track where supercars go to, and it was the commencement really of the New Zealand summer season. We had some historic cars there and a really great lineup of people that came. But let me tell you, the queue of Kiwi fans for him to wish him well before he went off, young and old, you name it, was absolutely off the scale. It was a really cool send-off.
Oh, would have been.
So we caught up with him during that moment and asked him, and he had basically spent a lot of time in the simulator trying to understand the way that Max drove the car, set the car up to try and get his head around the best way to adapt to that. So I think that just sort of underscores for you how tricky that second seat is. Max is obviously just a freak, just unbelievably good. I thought that Liam would be able to adapt, but it was brutal the way he was treated. In my opinion, it's only my opinion, they should have given him a longer chance at it. But anyway.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, two races is ridiculous.
I feel like that with many seats.
Yeah.
Poor kid. But yeah, to his credit, he is definitely climbing back up, which is wonderful.
Exactly.
Yeah, and so nice for the whole country to be behind him. You know, a small nation like New Zealand, I can just imagine that they would all feel totally invested in his career and wish him well, a bit like us with Oscar Piastri in Australia and to a lesser extent nowadays, just because of circumstances, Jack Doohan. But you've had Oscar on your show. What was he like as interview talent?
Very good. You get a window, you might be 10 or 15 minutes, whatever it is, and I always try and observe that, try and do the right thing. I'll go in with a mixture of questions that I'm thinking about that I hope the audience is considering, and also a few fan questions. And he is great. Gosh, there are times where his mannerisms and his love of general sport, I mean, you girls know that he hangs out sometimes with the Aussie cricketers and stuff like that. He reminds me of Mark Webber. I'm not surprised that from the managerial stuff, but just even the choice of words or the way that he says them. And I love that in recent weeks, don't you think we're seeing a bit more of his personality coming through and some of the things that they're doing, which is excellent.
Yeah, it is. It is really good. I saw a clip just during the week of Oscar. God, he must have been, I don't know, 10 or 11 years old, having won a race, and he was giving an interview after, I think it was a karting race, and he sounded exactly the same. Yeah, it was like, oh, I laughed. It was hilarious.
He seems so very mature and level-headed and very put together in the way that he speaks, and I would not expect an 11-year-old to sound like that. So there you go.
I mean, isn't that the reflection of why we have this cool, calm customer in the heat of battle at the moment, making really good choices? I think even at that early age, Di, you got a window into the sort of personality or the way that he's built. And to your point about the karting, the track, his home track in Melbourne. So Owen Kelly, a former supercars racer, his young son is competing in karts now, and I've been out there, and I'm not good on the tools for the record, but I've gone and helped on occasion with the family there. And that the club there and the circuit are hugely proud of Oscar, and they proudly call it his home track and so on. Yeah, really. It's good for the karting community that we've got these, you know, from Dan and even Mark before him and so on coming through. Mm-hmm. So let's hope the final 10 races are good for him. It's going to be epic watching for sure.
Oh my gosh.
Could you imagine being in the Oscar Piastri grandstand at the opening race of next year if he comes home with the world championship this year? It will be, I just got goosebumps thinking about it. It would be electric.
Honestly, if it's not a public holiday in Australia, if he wins the world championship, then there'll be riots on the street. Honestly.
It's 1980.
God, we've waited long.
1980. Alan Jones, right? So we've been crying out for this. He's a really good chance, but I mean, you have to admire the way that Lando has fought back recently. A lot of people have questioned his mental toughness, and he's shown some real toughness of late. It's very good to watch.
Yeah, I have to agree with you there.
Well, I think that since, like, he came out and said that he stopped social media, and I feel like that's made a huge difference to him. I mean, obviously there's more going on than just not scrolling, but yeah, his mental fortitude has really increased since, maybe the last six or so races.
Arguably started building probably since Monaco, didn't it? It didn't in some respects. And then, you know, British Grand Prix and so on. So, and you know what they're like, those athletes, they trade on that stuff. So you get one in the bank, which builds a bit of confidence, and then off you go. Maybe this will become a battle of who has the less down days between now and the end of the championship. And Oscar's been ultra consistent in that regard. So if he can keep playing that card, but you know, we're seeing a resurgent, a stronger Lando Norris at the moment, and then for that reason, it will be compulsive viewing. It really will be between now and Abu Dhabi.
I know, how lucky that we've got a season like this to watch. It's fantastic.
My stomach is already in knots, and we are not even at the last race of the season, sitting on we're not at the decider yet. Yep. And I'm like, it just makes me sick thinking about it because
you will be a nervous wreck, I promise you. Yes.
Oh my God.
I think every Australian Formula One fan will be. Yeah.
I can't even deal with it right now. Next.
I'm just
take a deep breath, Monique.
I'm a little older than you, but I can remember 2010, and I was very, very lucky with Channel 10 to go to.
Tell us.
So I went to the decider that year in Abu Dhabi, and which was a very new venue, and I went with James Allen, a very respected former F1 commentator, and for the Channel 10 broadcast, we did something hybrid. So we had a couple of hosts in Daryl Beattie and Craig Baird back in the studio, and they would throw to us on the ground, on the grid, the deciding race, and I got to speak to Mark as he was literally coming out of the pit lane onto the grid to jump into the car. And that year, Monique, there were three of them. There were three of them mathematically in contention: Mark Webber, Sebastian Vettel, and Fernando Alonso. And it was unbelievable. Fernando's
all amazing drivers.
Fernando in the Ferrari, their camp, and he was engineered that year by an Aussie in Chris Dyer. They made a decision to pit at a certain point in the race. Mark moved to cover. Sebastian was doing some great things. I think he qualified on pole that year, and it was incredible. So that was Sebastian's first win, and lots of Aussies had so much riding on it with Mark that year. So I can remember the kind of nerves that you're talking about there, and it was very good memories for me. James Allen, who'd been a commentator along with the great Murray Walker at one point. I mean, he knew everyone on the grid, so we could go and wander up and talk to all these people before they set off for the deciding race. Yeah, very, very fond memories for me.
Wow.
How amazing.
What we're also going to be, what's very clear, I've just done a short cast on AI and its involvement in motorsport and what a tool it's becoming. And it's far more prevalent in things like Formula One, but already becoming a thing in supercars and so on. And I think one of the experts that I had on is Trevor Long, who does all the tech and gadget reporting for the Today Show in Australia. And he can see a raft of benefits from this in the way that it integrates with stats and data and timing and so on to be able to give the viewer another level of experience. So to the point where Monique might go, what? If Lando had pitted then, what would that mean right now? And to try and have that sort of additional asset for the fan. And we're going to see more of that. They're talking about things in America at venues where you'll have the ability to do instant replays in the palm of your hand. So you'll walk in, you'll have the app for I'm talking generically here. I don't necessarily mean Formula One, but whatever the sport is or whatever the motor racing event is there, and you'll have the app for the event because you're the paying patron. You might pay a bit extra for it, and then it'll offer all these additional benefits. That's the kind of thing that will come for those in the stands over time.
It's pretty incredible to see the advances in technology and what that allows us in, even if we're just looking in the sporting sense, in the F1 sense, because I personally am not a fan of AI in the creative sense because we're creative, but in the data sense and in what it can give you and provide you. So even looking 20, 30 years ago in Formula One to today, the ability that we have to time down to the nanosecond, it's just incredible. And so it's kind of, I guess, easy to see how far we can take the access that we have to data, to instant replays, all that sort of stuff. I really don't think it would be that far in the future, right?
Maybe the answer is actually somewhere in between, that we harness it and embrace it in such a way that it does give us a event benefit, a broadcast benefit, whatever that might be. But it still remains a human game. I'm big on that. To the point where when I'm doing the podcast, I write the ep descriptions for Rusty's Garage, and I am the kids laugh at me because I go, Dad, AI could really help you here. It could give you a base, and off you go. It'd be so much faster. But I can see your point. For me, it will always be a human game. Seeing the teams on the wall, seeing the drivers going head to head, and emotional good and bad things that roll out because of that may that never change, please.
Oh, 100%. Hearing them on the radio and the interactions that they have, that's what makes it exciting. It's not looking at screens and screens and screens of data. It is the human element for sure.
Oh, 100%, which is why Drive to Survive has been so successful in bringing in so many new fans into the sport, isn't it? It's showing that human element and all the emotion behind it.
Speaking of Drive to Survive, one of the biggest stars, Daniel Ricciardo, you've also spoken to him and met him, right?
Yes. It actually began way back when. So, I can't sit here and profess to be a super close friend of his, but we ran into each other at the Singapore Grand Prix or wherever. He's always super nice and we'll stop and have a conversation. But Channel 10 dispatched me the year that he was getting his break in Formula One to go. I can't remember whether it was between Hispania and Toro Rosso or before he started in the Hispania. He did a couple of races in that car, remember? Anyway, I went to Perth and sat down with Joe and Grace, his parents, and they're just the most lovely people. And you know what television is like, right? Like, we need overlay, we need B-roll. So I need vision of mum and dad, and we need things that they're doing. And so the natural old school thing was to get out photo albums and look back through photo albums of a young Daniel, right? So we're doing that with beautiful photos of him. And he's always been right through his, like, you know, Grace is showing me the album. There's always this smiley, happy, beautiful kid, right? No wonder he is the way that he is now. And she got a little bit of a tear in her eye. And it was the kind of reality that I think her son was at an age and stage in life where he was heading off overseas and living away from home and chasing this big thing. And I've never asked him about it, but I gather from people that, you know, even when you're reflecting on Liam Lawson before and so on, you know, those that come through that Red Bull system, particularly when you're at that next stage where you haven't made it to a max level or won races like Daniel and Mark Webber did or whatever, the pressure in those moments where they're deciding whether you can cut it or not, whether they'll promote you or not, is absolutely immense. Absolutely immense.
Yeah.
You know, it's a little wonder we're seeing him. He's grown that long beard. He's gone to Alaska and all. He's kind of doing all these things that he didn't get to do when he was younger, probably, you know. So
he's not clean cut Daniel anymore.
He's a good guy, genuinely good guy. I would love for it to have continued and to have not stopped the way that it did. At the moment, he's clearly enjoying a really good break from motor racing and Formula One and so on. But I'd love to think that he might be tempted to do a couple of one-off things just to tick a bucket list, whether it's a Le Mans or a Bathurst 1000 or something or other. His involvement in one of those things. He's a racer.
Or speaking of different kind of broadcasts, Daniel's a funny guy.
Well, he's done a bit of it, right? So I listened to a podcast called Smartless. Jason Bateman, the actor, is a part of that. Will Arnett, the comedian. There's three of them.
Yep.
They started it in COVID. And the premise of it is that one guest would find someone A-list from the movies, from music, from sport, whatever it might be. But the other two have no idea who the guest is. So the podcast starts, "Hi, everybody. Welcome to another edition." Da-da-da-da-da. They do an intro where the other two have got to try and guess who the guest is. The guest pops up. "G'day, it's Matthew McConaughey," or whoever it might be. And they've got to then interview him for an hour with no preparation, right? So it's fantastic. So Daniel's been a guest on that podcast. He got to know Will Arnett. And then for a while there in the short break that he had from the sport before he came back, he did some alternate style coverage. I think it was for ESPN in the States with Will Arnett. He's not a stranger to the broadcast. Yeah, yeah.
Rossi, have you done any racing yourself?
A little. So I have a go-kart now for fun with mates. I'm not great at it, but what work has afforded me over the time is the chance to sample some stuff, Di. So three or four supercars. I drove a Formula 4 at the Sepang circuit in Malaysia, a Formula Holden that Rick Kelly used to race. So that's back in the day. That was probably as close to an F3000 or a bit like a Formula 2 car now, similar style thing to that. And a few others over time. But to be honest, it's more just, they're the moments of great perspective because you do that and you get a glimpse at how difficult their world is. And if you ever look at a lap time, you're miles off where the good drivers are. So your appreciation for what they do together with the people around them, that, I mean, I've been for passenger rides on the MotoGP bike at Phillip Island and in the F1 car at Albert Park.
Wow.
And
what, the two-seater F1 car?
Two-seater F1 car. And both of them, after only three laps, you go, how in the heck, you know, in the MotoGP sense, it's the race, I think, is 29 laps at Phillip Island. After three laps, you're absolutely exhausted. And it's a similar thing in the F1 car. As a passenger. So how the heck do they do it? So you learn very quickly just how good they are. And in general media for a long time, it's been hard for some of my colleagues to appreciate that they are athletes. Yes, the machine is good. Yes, the people around them are good. And invariably, you end up in a situation where the top teams might have the better equipment or people, and sometimes they're hard to beat because of that. But never underestimate what the athlete brings to the table. But you can't just put anyone in there and expect that they'll be able to do it because the car's been the best for some time. It's not like that at all.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the perception perhaps was that anyone could jump in an F1 car, and if they knew how to drive, could drive it pretty fast. Going back to how Formula One started, I'm talking about the era of James Hunt, the smoking, drinking, partying, that mm-hmm. kind of, they weren't so concerned with nutrition and fitness, but now, they're just machines, aren't they, themselves, human machines.
Yeah. I think their necks are probably thicker than a rugby player's.
And they do so much in that regard around, like Greg Murphy went back to Bathurst for a one-off wild card at age 50 in recent years. And as a part of the story and the build-up, I got to do all the training with him, and we went to a very specialised training facility with heat chambers and all that. So I got to experience that for the first time. And one of the things they started doing was around the neck strength. So you'll have seen Monique on socials and things when they're using the machines. Man, that's so hard, some of that stuff. But you've talked about eras, Di. I mean, Niki Lauda in that era with James Hunt, he started to change things in his level of discipline and what he brought to the table. You could argue that Ayrton Senna really took it to a whole new level, and then Michael Schumacher did the same again. So we've seen those key figures come through, and now all of them. I mean, they're proper athletes that would be very comfortable doing long-distance cycling or half marathons or whatever it might be.
Well, a lot of them do, don't they? Like
Bottas does.
Exactly. Valtteri did an indoor Ironman last year.
Just because.
Just right. Without even planning it. He decided the day before and just did it.
He was with us for the Race of Champions at the beginning of the year in Sydney.
What's that?
The Finnish ambassador to Australia presented him before the event got underway with a certificate that basically said he's an honorary Aussie. Because we love him in this country. He's just such a breath of fresh air in that regard.
It'd be so good to see him back racing.
Yeah.
He said he's still got racing left in him. It's what he wants to do. And he's such a great personality. Let's hope it happens.
I think his extracurricular activities, he cycles with Tiffany all the time. He just did a massive cycle through Sweden, I think it was, a competition or a rally or something. And I think that kind of shows his dedication to sport and high-level sports as well, because he wasn't a cyclist until he started dating Tiffany, and now all of a sudden he's doing these massive competitions. He doesn't have to be doing anything now. He's a reserve driver. He could sit back and go to his meetings and, you know, do his job, but he is showing consistent commitment to doing high-level sport. He wants to drive.
The moment someone says, hey, will you come drive for us, he wants to be ready to do that. So I'm not surprised. Yeah. I'm not surprised that he's kept himself sharp. I love the fact we've probably since the full-time Mercedes days, we've seen a bit more of his personality, and he'd be welcome back on the grid in that role.
Oh, 100%, 100%. Hopefully Cadillac will let him keep his mullet and mustache. But is he going to have to become an honorary American?
I think you'll be fine.
But I mean, they've got mullets and mustaches too. Okay, good, great. I take your word for it, Rusty.
Keep the character.
Yes, that's, you know, we want to see that. Yeah. We're enjoying seeing people's personalities come through. So, yeah.
I have a story on the Rush movie. There's a little bit of swearing in it.
I love that movie.
Oh, I love that movie too. It's my favourite racing movie. Let's hear the Rush story, Rusty.
Okay.
Tell us.
So the Australian Grand Prix Corporation, when this movie came out, so firstly, there are two aspects to this story. So Ron Howard made the movie, and he went quite in depth with his research around it at the time, and he was trying to find someone in the family who filmed the original crash and fire for Niki Lauda at the Nürburgring in the mid-70s, right? There is vision of the crash, and it's quite confronting. And what had happened, I did a story for a magazine motorsport show called RPM on Channel 10 back in the day that encapsulated kind of Niki's career, and it had this vision in it. And I voiced it, and somehow or other it made its way to YouTube. And Ron Howard retweeted this thing and said, I'm trying to track this down. I don't know Ron Howard, right? I don't profess to know him. But I said, hey, this is just a story that we did to encapsulate it, but good luck finding them. But what really impressed me in that moment was the depth that Howard was going to in order to tell this story. So when the launch came around, some of the stars came out for it, and I went to the Melbourne launch, and Daniel Brühl, who played Niki Lauda in the movie, came out to Melbourne for the launch, and they said to me, look, will you go down to the front of the movie screen and interview him for 15 minutes or so before we roll the movie? And I said, I would be so honoured. I'd love to do that. So as we're shooting the breeze there, I said, Daniel, invariably, most actors like to try and get into character, to learn the person and their nuances and what they're like and really try and mimic them, but authentically. I said, did you spend some time with Niki Lauda, who's now gone, very sadly? And he said, eventually, yes. He said, I kept trying him for months and it seemed as though that he wasn't interested. He said, and one Sunday morning, the phone rings and it's like 6 or 7 a.m. at home. And Daniel picks up the phone and he hears this voice and he goes, okay, I suppose we have to meet now. Just bring hand luggage to Vienna. That way, if you don't like each other, you can just piss back off to where you came from. They hit it off, the pair of them. And Niki had him back on several occasions and it really helped Daniel to properly get into Nikki's character, which I thought he did so well in that movie. It was very good.
Yeah. Wow. Imagine picking up the phone to hear Niki Lauda's voice on the other end.
Yeah. Like, just straight into it.
It's so cool. Mm.
Exactly. Yeah. It's so direct. If we don't like each other, you can just go.
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
Oh, yeah, that's
Rush.
Brilliant.
What a great film. If you haven't seen Rush, do yourself a favor. It's one of the greatest racing movies. I would put it up there probably better than the latest F1. What did you think of F1 movie?
I liked it. But I went into it with the right perspective. I said to a couple of people I know that are diehard, like dyed-in-the-wool motor racing fans, said, I didn't like it for this reason or that reason. And I said, you're looking at it the wrong way. There was always going to be
Hollywood.
Exactly. With Bruckheimer and Joseph Kosinski and all those guys, they were always going to do a few Hollywood-esque things. So for me, it was twofold. The way Formula One let them in and gave them access and allowed them to immerse themselves in the sport, in sport generally, that is almost unheard of. There's very rare for a movie over time. It has happened, but it's very rare that the sport goes, okay, off you go. You're a part of the game. You're a part of the game while you're filming. Okay, that's pretty, pretty impressive.
Not just one race.
Correct.
This went on for like 18 months.
Brad drove several laps in an F2 car and did all of these things to try and get up to speed. But the thing that I don't profess to be technically across all these things, but the way the camera technology that they used to capture the speed, to capture the intensity, I thought was awesome. Yeah, very good. I've seen it three times. Mm-hmm. The first time I saw it in 4DX, and my wife was with some friends. I don't know if you've ever done that. So you're in these seats. These motion seats. Yeah. And I was like, oh my God, I just want to watch the movie. I don't want to move. And you know, like a car would come past, someone would overtake somebody and you get this puff of air on the back of your neck, like the car. And then if it's a wet race, you know, a bit of water gets splashed at you and all this kind of stuff. It's crazy.
Gosh.
Crazy. Yeah. It's like, it's not quite a roller coaster ride, but you do move around a bit, you know.
That kind of sounds like a fun way to see it. I'm not going to lie, but To touch on your point about the camera and the angles and stuff that they got, when Di and I were initially talking about our experiences having seen the film, I went into it thinking I was going to hate it because I hate Hollywood films. They make me roll my eyes all the time. And I thought that the camera work and all the action was going to be the downfall of the movie for me because that seems like I just don't understand why every Hollywood film needs to have ridiculous action scenes. But I was so impressed with it. That didn't bother me in the slightest. I thought it was great. It was the storyline that got me.
Lewis Hamilton, as you know, was part of the producing team on that. And they say in the final cuts, when he went in to preview it, before they showed it to the drivers and before they released it to the world, he was so good at things like, hang on a minute, that sound there. They're in fourth gear on the soundtrack, but in the race, they're really in fifth gear at that point. You need to fix that. And he got into real detail around that stuff. So those sorts of things, oh, yes, it's Hollywood, and yes, there's things that some didn't like about it, but the fact that they went to that sort of level, the camera technology, the sound, all that sort of stuff, I reckon was awesome. I'm very likely to go to the Baja 1000 in the coming months for some work. And the kids just said to me tonight, Dad, does that mean you'll be where Sonny is at the end of driving on the sand? I don't know if I'll be Sonny, and I don't know but yes. It's, yeah.
Oh, I love that. See, and again, it's bringing your kids into this world that they wouldn't have known about or maybe wouldn't have been interested in because it's, you know, dad's world, and it's brought them into this sport and this world. Yeah, it's so cool. And you can talk to them about that.
Yeah, I wonder how many people had never even heard of the Baja 1000 before.
Correct.
Watching the movie. Probably 90% of the audience.
And yet it's huge. It's huge in huge in the States. To your point, Monique, just quickly, the very first time they came with me, just as fans, they weren't working, but they came with me to the Singapore Grand Prix, and I'm heading up there again in September. I love it there. My youngest, Stella, was with me, and she's quite a Lando fan, and she's quite an outgoing kid. Both the girls are, thankfully. But I could see she was a little bit daunted in the moment. I said, "Darling, Lando is coming. If you're courteous and you go and ask him for an autograph," I said, "but you'll kind of get one chance. They're so busy that they get mobbed by people. So don't be afraid." So she got the gumption to go and do it, which was awesome. And she got a nice selfie with him. But here's the story, right? In all the how massive Drive to Survive has made all of them, we were walking out of Singapore that night at 2 a.m. because the race finishes late and the drivers are, you know, whatever, 1:30 a.m. And as we're going towards the turnstiles, George Russell was coming. And Stella, by this stage, had a bit more confidence. And so she goes, "Would you mind if I got a selfie with you?" And he said, "Yeah, of course, of course." And so she took the picture and then was conscious not to hold him up any longer. And she went to walk away and he goes, "Hey, I don't think that worked. Do you want to do it again?" And she looked and she looked and she goes, would you mind?" And he goes, "Of course, no problem." This is 2 a.m. in the morning. They had a really nice photo together. And I thought, man, there you go, right? Like, he would be mobbed all weekend long by all of these people. The last thing he's probably thinking about is, "Oh God, another one. And he stopped her and did that. And that to me, that said a lot about George Russell, the right there, that little moment.
Yeah. He's just gone up another notch, in my opinion, for that.
Yeah. Oh, just to make your fans' day as well, like that. What an absolute darling.
Yeah, respect.
Well, thanks for sharing that.
There you go.
Great story.
My pregnancy hormones are, like, going to make me cry.
We're into the final three.
You have three questions for me. I'm nervous. What are my three questions?
So, Rusty, if you could travel for a holiday to any destination where Formula One's held, whether it's race week or not, whether it's a current race destination or not, where would you go for a holiday and why?
Italy, Monza. 12 months ago, we had a family holiday. But the trip, just the way it worked out and the things that the kids wanted to do, we didn't get to go to Ferrari HQ and I didn't get to go to Monza. That's okay, because hopefully in time we'll go back and do that. I love that part of the world. And when we were going into Milan and things like that by train, I kept looking out the window going, it's not that far to Monza. It is not that far to Monza. So that's on the list.
Monza is high up on my list as well. And next year's the plan.
Good.
Let's hope it all goes to plan.
Make it happen.
All right. Question number two. If you could holiday with any Formula One driver, dead or alive, who would you choose to holiday with and why?
That is hard.
I know.
That
question.
Is hard. Okay. I never got to meet Ayrton Senna. I would love to have had even a 10-minute interview, something just to sort of get to understand how he ticked a little bit. I got to talk with Mario Andretti on the pit wall one year at the Gold Coast, and I was quite young. I was a young reporter at that stage, and I was super nervous, and he could not have been a more engaging man. I'd love to have Mario at that dinner table with me and reminisce about him going as a young man from Italy to America and the opportunities he created and going on to race in Formula One and so on. I'd love that dinner to get a group of Aussies together, you know, to think that we might have maybe Mark Webber, Daniel Ricciardo, Oscar Piastri of the modern era together. That would be a really cool private dinner where we just sort of shot the breeze about different things and had a laugh. I reckon that'd be awesome. And I've sort of ticked one box.
It'd be
a very interesting one.
I feel like getting all three of those Aussies together, interesting, because didn't Daniel Ricciardo take Mark Webber's Red Bull seat and then Oscar Piastri took Daniel Ricciardo's McLaren seat,
I hadn't paused to think about that, but Mark
could have been interesting.
Great dinner to be.
Mark took a group of us to a meal in the lead up to Albert Park one year, and the journalists, both international and Australian, and we had a meal in Melbourne there, and it never dawned on me at the time, and that was his little way at that stage of saying thank you. And he announced later in the year that he was off to race sports cars with Porsche and that his time in Formula One was coming to an end. I was very honoured to go to that, and what a nice thing. That tells you a bit about the bloke and how he thinks. That he'd I guess, already come, maybe he hadn't, but it felt like he'd come to that decision in his mind, and that was his way of saying thank you to the Journos.
If you could cook any dish from any of the countries that Formula One goes to in the Formula One calendar, what would you choose and why? I know, we don't ask the easy questions.
This is hard. This is hard. For me, a meal is experiential. So it's about the people you're with, it's about the place you're in and what's going on at the time. So to be at a Formula One event somewhere, wherever that might be, I mean, that's a huge, huge tick before you even start. We've talked about some people that might join us. That's ace. What would my go-to meal be? I'm sounding like I'm leaning into Italian here, but it would be something, maybe a good pasta or something along those lines. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very popular choice.
Oh, what a wonderful chat. And you've been so generous with your stories. And I hope you've enjoyed reliving some of those memories of, gosh, what's it been, 30 years in motorsport?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well.
Thank you both for having me on. It's been nice to reminisce a little bit. And you know what you've done now? You've created a real drama for me, because I'm going to go and tell the girls that we've been having these conversations. They'll be like, right, when are we going to Monza? So that'll be my next drama now. So thank you to you both for starting that.
Girls hound dad. What?
Exactly. Exactly.
Girls, you're welcome.
If you guys enjoyed what you listened to or watched, if you happen to be watching us on YouTube, you can like, comment, review, rate, do it all. You can also follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, LinkedIn, TikTok, and Instagram. And you can also email us at andawaywego f1podcast@gmail.com.
Oh, it's been such a great chat. And if you don't already listen to Rusty's Garage, go and listen to Rusty's Garage. He's always got fabulous guests on with great stories. But thank you very much for listening and having us in your ears. Until next week and until lights out.
It's lights out and away we go.
And Away We Go podcast is produced by Diane Bortoletto and Monique Ciccato. Let's do it.